when you hand it to the composer in sonic branding, at that point, it becomes an art, because the job of the composer, of course, is to translate those desired emotions into music. And it's not music that the composer feels, it is the music, it is what it makes the audience feel when they hear it. And that is almost pure art. We have done some science around it, and we know what might help in terms of instrumentation and timbre and pitch and all that sort of stuff. But at the bottom line, the sonic logo is only going to be as good as the composer. And they are the most important person in the sonic branding project, bar none.
Welcome to Audio Branding, the hidden gem of marketing. Sound plays a more important role in human behavior and our decision-making than you may realize. In this podcast, I'll help you understand the art and science of sound so you can better influence others in business and your life. I'm your host, Jody Krangle. Let's delve a little deeper. Here's the first part of my conversation with David Courtier Dutton. My next guest is the founder and CEO of SoundOut. He's on a mission to prove that sound isn't just art, it's strategy. From building the world's largest music testing platform to decoding how sonic logos tap straight into our memory and emotions, he's turned the science of sound into a tool brands can't ignore and has worked with brands such as Amazon, TikTok, Netflix, Sky, and Target to help optimize their sonic branding and marketing. His name is David Courtier Dutton, and we'll talk about what makes audio unforgettable, how data reveals our hidden reactions to music, and where the future of audio branding might be headed. As always, if you have questions for my guest, you're welcome to reach out through the links in the show notes. If you have questions for me, visit audiobrandingpodcast.com, where you'll find a lot of ways to get in touch. Plus, subscribing to the newsletter will let you know when the new podcasts are available, along with other interesting bits of audio-related news. And if you're getting some value from listening, the best ways to show your support are to share this podcast with a friend and leave an honest review. Both those things really help, and I'd love to feature your review on future podcasts. You can leave one either in written or in voice format from the podcast's main page. I would so appreciate that. And now, here's my conversation with David Courtier Dutton. Well, thank you for joining me, David. This is great. I'm really looking forward to our discussion.
Thank you, JD. Well, it's great to be here and very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, I appreciate your time. So the very first question that I ask all of my guests is if you can tell me about an early memory of how sound moved you. Do you have one of those, like from your childhood or something?
Oh, okay. So, I think I first woke up to music probably about age six. I was sitting in a very old Morris Minor. So this is over 50 years ago. And my mother was helping somebody butcher a sheep and turning it into mince. And I was stuck in the car, and on the radio came the song, I think it's John Lennon, Give Me Love, I think it's called Peace on Earth. And it just hit me between the eyes. And I sat and I listened to it, and it seared that moment in my brain. Of all the very few memories you have when you're 6, 7 years old, it just stuck with me. And I lost the song for probably about 30 years or so. And then when I heard it again, I was straight back in that little car, absolutely transfixed by the radio. At that point, I wasn't involved in music, but I see it and hear it all the time now in the work that we do. And that ability a piece of music just to bind you to a moment in time or an emotion in time is quite phenomenal.
Yeah, totally. And I totally understand that as well. It's like time travel.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. So what is your background in audio? Because at some point you decided to make that your thing. So step us through the progress of how you got there.
Oh, well, this is non-standard. So I originally qualified as a lawyer in the City of London, working on corporate law. I then left that and moved into corporate finance, so advising companies on IPOs and mergers and acquisitions. And there I was working in what was known as a small companies team, so companies under $50 million market cap. I got a lot of exposure to the commercial side of finance, etc. And then one day was asked by one of our clients, an internet B2B company, to come and join them and work with them. So I did that in about 1997, 98, just before the dot-com boom. And it went nuts. It was a crazy 3 years. I went up to the board of that business. I became strategic development director. And we saw the share price or the market cap of the business increase from about $25 million to $2.5 billion in 18 months. So we rode the dot-com boom. I led the flotation of the IPO onto the London Stock Exchange. And then, of course, April 2000 happened, the dot-com bubble burst spectacularly. I left about a year later and went into property development for about 5 years, high-end property development. And then the internet bug got me again. And this was the time when MySpace was just exploding. And on MySpace, there were 12.5 million bands at that point and 18 or 19 million users. And for the first time in history, fans of artists could actually directly connect with the artists themselves. And I'm sure not that many people on your podcast can remember back this far. But at that point, the big headline was that the music industry had had its day. Everything was going to be disintermediated. The major labels were going to fail.
I remember those days.
Exactly. It was all over. Yeah. It was a time of Napster, and LimeWire and music sharing. And the industry was appeared to be facing existential moments. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if the industry is going to go away and fans can connect with the bands, why don't we create a business that enables the fans to actually invest in the bands themselves and actually finance them by effectively pre-purchasing an album that hadn't been made yet? And we created a platform called Slice of Pie that enabled us to do just that, where bands could upload their music. It was listened to and reviewed by thousands of reviewers. The very best bands then went up for financing, and they then raised money from the fans. The fans took a stake in the success of the band going forward. It was a very early version of Patreon and the other businesses that are around now. In fact, it was the first one.
Like Kickstarter.
It was Kickstarter for music. That's exactly what it was. And we financed about 35 bands. But very early on, probably about 3 or 4 months into the launch of the business, we found that the data coming out from the review process of the music was really fascinating. So we could play consumers the same song. We could play completely different groups of consumers the same song many, many times over. And when we consolidated their feedback, we would always get the same rating for the song. So we kind of stumbled across the wisdom of crowds, but in a music environment. And very quickly, within about a year, decided to actually set up a parallel business called SoundOut, which is the same name as the business today, that was specialized in testing music with consumers. And this was going to be directed at the major record labels and radio groups worldwide. And I'll stop there because I could probably go on for another 5 or 10 minutes. So the ins and outs and ups and downs of how disastrous that was initially, and then how successful it became, and then how that evolved into what we do today.
Well, so I'm curious then, when you first realized sound could drive brand memory, like when did you make that association?
Okay, so this is rolling forward. So we'll sort of jump 10 years from 2007 when we launched. And after 10 years, we'd become the number one music testing business in the US market. We were working with probably 65, 70% of all the US major labels and all the sub-labels, so Universal, Sony and Warner and many of their sub-labels. We were working with Reverb Nation, who are white labeling our testing for thousands of bands on their site, TuneCore, relationship that they exist to this day. And we kind of saturated the music market in terms of testing. So we decided that we needed to expand to it. We had this great panel. At that point, it was about 2.5 million US consumer strong. And we started doing brand testing for people like Unilever and Henkel and others. And this is really around core brand positioning. So Unilever have a whole suite of hair care brands, shampoos or whatever. They want each hair care brand to have its own personality and to be differentiated from the others. So when somebody switches brand, they're switching from a competitor to one of their brands. They're not cannibalizing their family of brands by having brands that effectively compete against each other. And to do that, we started working with a couple of very senior consultants, ex-Unilever, who'd run large parts of Unilever before. And they began to walk us into a number of projects. So this was outside music completely. But in doing that, over a couple of years, we learned a huge amount about brands, brand positioning, brand strategy, the tension between branding and marketing, et cetera, et cetera. And then at around the same time, 2017, 2018, we'd started working with Goldsmiths, University of London, and one of the leading musicologists or music psychologists in the world, a guy called Professor Daniel Mullen-Stephen. And we were exploring the academic literature around sound and marketing and branding and how we might commercialize aspects of that. And that came to a head in, I suppose, 2018, 2019, where we were invited in to do some testing work on a sonic branding project for, I cannot even remember the brand. I don't think it was AccuWeather was one of the first. It might have been Lidl or something like that. And we went in and we put together our music testing expertise with our music psychology expertise and some new models and frameworks that we built with Goldsmiths. And we did a sonic branding project. And then about, I suppose, 6-9 months later, I was over in Amsterdam and just by chance had a meeting with a business called Massive Music, who are probably the leading sonic branding business in the world. And we clicked and we spent 2 or 3 very happy years doing dozens of sonic branding projects as their testing partner, which really launched us into the space. And so, yes, it was bringing those 3 threads of music testing, branding expertise, and music psychology together in one package that gave us the, I suppose, the credibility to actually sit at the table and start helping brands around music.
That's great. Yeah. And quite the evolution, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is an evolution, but we love change. We always think of ourselves mm-hmm. as a technology company that works in music rather than a music company that uses technology.
Hi, this is Will Seabrook, and you're listening to the Audio Branding Podcast, a great place to learn about how powerful sound can be. If you want to understand how to harness that power in your own life, keep listening.
So you've worked with a lot of different brands in the area of sonic branding, obviously. What do you see them getting wrong?
Oh.
Because I'm sure there are a lot of things that people are not paying attention to that they should when they're doing this.
God, where do I start? So I think to preface this, we have worked on, I would guess, somewhere probably about 75 sonic branding projects over the last 6-7 years. We have yet to meet a single individual on the brand side who has ever done a sonic branding project before.
Really?
Yeah.
That surprises me a lot, especially now.
Yeah, obviously in agencies you meet people, but actually in the brands themselves, we've yet to meet one person who said, yep, I did this with so-and-so or whatever. So they come in, not wet behind the ears, but
we need an education, I guess.
Exactly. So the main, not mistakes they made, but they how do I say this politely? They do get upset. Number one, the process is really good fun. If you work in branding and you're used to fonts and colors and, you know, where to position a logo on a page and all that sort of stuff, actually doing a solid branding project that sort of parachutes you into a massive creative process that's all about music. And there's nobody who doesn't enjoy that. So they do, they really enjoy it, but they also tend to get very attached. They overthink things. They get really attached to the sounds, and they start reading things into the options and the logos that perhaps don't exist. They forget that this sonic logo will just be pinged out across the airwaves and listened to fleetingly by consumers. And you can really overthink it, because at the end of the day, the really important thing in sonic branding is consumer attribution. They're going to recognize the brand from the sonic logo. And
does that happen from repetition?
That happens. That happens from
all sorts of ways.
Yes. Strategically, how they use it, how they place it. But yeah, repetition, mm-hmm. As I call it, you know, carpet bombing of the sonic logo into the advertising medium relentlessly, and you will get attribution. And the reality is you can move the dial by having an amazing sonic logo rather than having an average one, but it is repetition is really important. So the goal when they're creating the logo should be make sure it's on brand, that it that the emotions and the personality it projects or creates in the mind of the consumer is aligned with the brand. So the brand is being consistent. Make sure it doesn't irritate them. Try and make it distinctive. Make it likable, because the more people like a piece of music, the more memorable it is. It's just a fact of life. And beyond that, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, good is good enough. It doesn't need to be brilliant. Don't overthink it. Just tick the boxes, you know, match to the brand, appeal, strong recallability, and then put it out there. And most of the magic is done in the marketing, not in the creation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems like, as you say, people could overthink this a lot. But is this an art or a science? Because I'm assuming that you're coming at these sonic logos and such after some research about the company. And is that science? And then it becomes art when you create the whatever it is?
Yeah, it is. It's a blend of both. I mean, if you call branding science, I suppose it is. So a brand at the end of the day, I know there are hundreds of definitions of what a brand is, but in our space, in the music space, the brand is the personality. It is how you make people feel.
I'm assuming there's some research data on what their audience feels they are
exactly.
Personality.
Yeah, so we always talk about... brands have two personalities. They have their actual personality, which is what you get if you ask people on the street. And then they have their aspirational personality, which is how they want to be perceived. And there are very, very few brands in the world where the actual and the aspirational is in lockstep. I mean, you can think people like Apple, Nike, a handful of others, who Netflix, you know, there are some that where people actually regard the personality of the brand in the same way as the brand wants to be perceived. But if you turn to things like banks and insurance companies and actually most media and brands, there's a gaping chasm between how they want to be perceived and how they are. And often it's just an amplitude issue. People feel a bit of something about the brand, but not very strongly. So to your question, is it an art or a science? There is a science around branding, which is they must be consistent, speak with the same tone of voice, same color scheme, same logo, and the sonic logo needs to lock into that. But the sonic logo follows, it does not lead. It needs to reflect the brand personality. But that is all more science. This is, you know, we want our logo to come across as family friendly, warm, energetic, whatever your six pillars or eight pillars of your brand may be. But then when you hand it to the composer in sonic branding, at that point, it becomes an art, because the job of the composer, of course, is to translate those desired emotions into music. And it's not music that the composer feels. It is the music. It is what it makes the audience feel when they hear it. And that is almost pure art. We have done some science around it. And we know what might help in terms of instrumentation and timbre and pitch and all that sort of stuff. But at the bottom line, the sonic logo is only going to be as good as the composer. And they are the most important person in a sonic branding project, bar none.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And you've done some research in your sound out study, right? So you've done a whole study on a whole bunch of these different audio brands and how they present themselves and how effective they are. So can you talk about what your sound out study really is, just so that people are aware?
Yeah, sure. It's a we do it every 2 years. Well, our first one we did was in 2021. And I think we did about 130 US brands then. And what we do is we go out to the market and test every single sonic logo with 200 consumers. And we also then test the visual logo of the brand with 200 consumers separately. And we get a personality plot using our framework that we call Brand Match. And that enables us to measure the match between how the brand is perceived and how well the logo fits. But we're also tracking recognition. Do people recognize the logos? Attribution, can they name the brand? Recall, propensity to buy, will it increase people's likelihood to buy? We're able to score each sonic logo against over 240 different brand attributes. And a whole host of other data. These studies, I mean, the latest one, this is our third one we've just put out 2 weeks ago. We involved 70,000 consumers to actually participate. So it's a very, very big study. And essentially what we're looking to do is create a ranking table of, in the latest study, 174 US sonic logos. Those that are most recognizable, those that are growing in recognition. So it's a tracking study as well to see how well they've moved forward or backwards over the last 2 years. And we do that obviously because, number one, there's nothing like it in the market. We're the only people who do a massive consumer study on sonic branding each 2 years. The tracking is really interesting. But at its core, what we are doing is creating a huge comparative database that we can benchmark client projects against to actually gauge how good their new logos are against all the competition, whether by sector or market or age group or whatever it may be.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I had a look over at myself and was really impressed with how deep you got into it. So that was interesting to look at.
It's very nerdy, but it's
that's okay. We're all about that here.
but it's great data, and it is the only consumer derived benchmarking data set in the world.
Sure. Were there any results that you were really surprised by when you got your latest survey back?
Yeah, I suppose the big finding this year, and maybe we should have done it 2 years ago or even 4 years ago, but all about, as I mentioned earlier, that brand attribution is actually the only metric that matters when a logo is out there. No one recognizes.
Well, advertising no one remembers is failed advertising, right?
Exactly. So yeah. Attribution is the key thing. And in previous surveys we did, we would always ask the question, do you recognize the brand associated with this logo? And it was a yes or a no, and that gave us our attribution number. And from that historic data, the key data point was that if you have your name in your sonic logo, the brand name and the sonic logo, then people were twice as likely to attribute it to the brand as if it wasn't in. So that's powerful. That's a good argument for putting the name in. But this year, we asked a follow-up question, which was name the brand. So people said, yeah, I can name the brand. I'm sure it's Apple or whatever. And then you ask them to type in what the brand name is. And even with fuzzy matching for spelling mistakes and whatever, we found that Sonic logos that did not include the name, 27% of people claimed that they recognized the brand. But when asked what the brand name was, only 5% got it right. So on average, across 100 or so Sonic logos, only 1 in 20 people can successfully name the brand.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Quick question. Do you know anyone else who could benefit from hearing more about how powerful sound can be? If so, would you mind sharing this podcast with them? It would mean so much to me. Now, I'll stop interrupting and let you get back to the show.
Why do you think that was?
Because...
Was that just faulty memory on people's part?
No, I mean, it's known as source amnesia. So that is when you can... It's like when you can recognize a song, you love it, you've heard it before, you cannot for the life of you remember who sung it or what the name of the song is. Whereas there are other songs that you listen to, you know, whether if we're talking, I don't know, Let It Be by the Beatles, you know, you hear a couple of notes, you got it. Let It Be, no problem, John Lennon rather than the Beatles, but it's very easy. But then when we look at Sonic logos with the brand name in, the claimed attribution is 60%. As opposed to 27% for no name, but the actual attribution was 46%. So almost 50% of people, 5 in 10, can name the brand from a logo with the brand name in, which is 9 times higher than if there is no brand name in the logo. Now, when it was twice as many people could do it, could name it with the brand name as not, there's an argument to be had. Shall we put the brand name in the logo? Shall we not? No, it's more flexible without. But when your attribution is going to be 9 times higher if you put the brand name in, to us, it becomes a no-brainer. You have to start there. By all means, start with the brand name in it. After 2 or 3 years, when it's established, drop the brand name out of it. But I think you have to be very bold now as a brand to not put your brand name in your Sonic logo. If you want your Sonic logo to actually do some heavy lifting.
Yeah, it was very interesting to see the study, like in the study where you mentioned how some of the big brands started with their name in the logo and then gradually phased it out.
Exactly.
That was interesting to see. Yeah.
Exactly.
So with all of these companies trying to vie for attention, which, you know, hopefully music or sound helps them do, how do they differentiate themselves? Like, what do you suggest that companies do to sound different from one another? Because how many of these logos can there be? And how many of them can sound different than someone else? Like, there are certain notes that we hear all the time that we like, and how many, you know, different ways of putting those notes together can you make something into a logo?
You're quite right. So it, you know, if you've got 3 seconds or 2 seconds to create a logo, you're not going to create something that has a hook as strong as Katy Perry or whatever it may be. It's always going to be a short snippet of a melody. And if you're looking at the MIDI, you know, there's very little between them. And therefore, you have to lean really heavily into instrumentation and impact. So it has to be, you want to get something distinctive, but not distinctive for the sake of being distinctive. It has to be as distinctive as possible without being jarring or annoying. And as I say, you could do that through impact, like a Netflix's ta-dum, you know, something that you just don't forget. You can do it. I can't remember which company it was. I think it might have been, I want to say B&Q, I don't think it was, where they played the logo on tools and electric drills and that sort of thing. Philips used the logo, played on light bulbs.
I know Tostitos did the same thing. Yeah. They did, they used their bags and the crunch of the chips and like all, you know, tap on the cover of the, you know, box or bag or whatever.
Exactly.
Interesting stuff. Yeah.
Exactly. So that you go a certain amount of the way, but as I said earlier, at the end of the day, it's about carpet bombing it with the association with the brand name or the brand image or radio ads, speaking the brand name over it again and again and again, or ideally having the brand name in the logo that's going to make it distinctive. And that's probably it. Again, putting the brand name in the logo will make it distinctive to your brand. But you're right.
Mm-hmm.
The melody itself, yeah. And it's not gonna kill it.
Yeah, it's tough to be distinctive in this day and age, actually.
100%.
But you've also mentioned that there's a sonic boom happening right now. And so I guess you're inferring that audio branding works. So how is it working, in your opinion? And can you talk about the hard evidence for this?
Yeah, I mean, this is something, this is a bit like the discussion around, you know, radio have been banging away about how much more bang you get for your buck with radio advertising as TV advertising. But most of the money, or TV or social, most of the money still goes to TV and social, and radio never gets its fair share of advertising. It drives them nuts. We know global radio here in Europe really well, Europe's biggest independent radio group. And they spend their life trying to convince brands that they should spend more on radio advertising because it works.
So and is streaming.
Yeah.
And it's like iHeart and Pandora and all of these, Sirius XM, all of them. Yeah.
Exactly. But the money won't go there. And I think, sonic branding has always been the Cinderella in the land of branding. It's always been an afterthought. And I think it's because there hasn't been any hard evidence or big studies around the actual impact of sound and music and sonic branding in advertising. And therefore, if you can't prove the benefit or the effectiveness, then it's very hard to assign the correct budget or the correct importance to it. There was a big study out earlier this year by System One, who basically are a testing company for brands. And I won't go into the detail of it. It's all downloadable from the System One website, but it has proved categorically across tens of thousands of adverts that sonic branding has the biggest impact on both brand awareness and also all sorts of other elements in terms of uplift in sales and whatever. But sonic branding is, I think it scored 191% uplift, which means nothing. But in contrast, having the brand name in the advert was only down at about 40%. So, and it's because, of course, sound is the only element that actually works on the subconscious. So you're effectively just plugging into an additional neural pathway that otherwise is not being utilized at all. And it is kind of the most important pathway because people can't block their ears. They can look away, they can be doing something at the same time, but you can't close off your ability to listen and for those connections to be made. So it's very subversive way of marketing, but highly effective.
This has been part one of our interview. I hope you'll tune in next week for part two. Well, that's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, why not tell a friend about this podcast? It's available in all the usual locations. Until next time.